Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome, UNC Family Medicine, to Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome back our great guest co-host, Dr. Caroline Roberts. Welcome, Caroline.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, well, I hope everyone's having a good day wherever they might be. And on our show today, we're going to have a good day because we actually get to talk with Dr. Robert McNutt, President and CEO of You Choose Medical, and author of a book called Your Health, Your Decisions, How to Work with Your Doctor to Become a Knowledge-Powered Patient. But first off, we're going to also talk about some really important research that matters. And I know you have a young child, 15-month-old, right?
I do. He just turned 15 months. Yes, sir.
Well, let's just go right to the heart of it. What type of smart device does he get to play with?
The correct answer should be none. However, I have the smartest child of all the children in
the world.
Of
course.
And so he has figured out what an iPhone is and is very interested in it.
Well, and you know the right answer. And this is something that we know that there's always a difference between, you know, kind of the reality. But what the research can show is something I think all of us can think about. And when my kids were younger, we didn't have these smartphones, but they would be maybe watching videos on TV, which I don't think was any better. But this was a study of 900 children between the ages of 6 months and 2 years, and they found that those who spent more time with handheld devices like smartphones were more likely to have delays in their speech, particularly expressive speech, compared to children who didn't use those devices as much.
Yeah, I found this really interesting. I mean, they quoted one specific number that said for every 30 minutes of screen time, there is a 49% increased risk of expressive speech delay. That's a substantial amount.
Right. Now, they may say, well, how often does expressive speech delay occur, which is – it's not rare.
No.
And, you know, if that means an hour a day of using a handheld device could certainly translate to a 90% excess risk. 2 hours a day could be 180%. I think as a parent, you know, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends against handheld devices or computers for children younger than age 18 months, even if they're being used as educational apps.
Well, I think, you know, it went on to comment a little bit on that, which I found interesting. It said that one thing that they weren't really able to study or they recognize kind of influences it as well as the amount of screen time that young children get may actually reflect social and cultural and economic factors that could also be a confounding factor in why the children might also experience expressive language delay, which I think is an important thing to recognize. But at the same point, I think the key is that we should not let our smartphones babysit our children.
Yeah, and I think we all have room for improvement. None of us is innocent in this smartphone expressive issue. And I think at any level, whether it's our children or the adults, spending maybe less time with those devices and more time in strenuous interaction with each other is a good thing.
Yes.
Let's talk about our very next research that matters, and it has to do with organic products, which we would both probably say are good things. But
yes,
this is about specifically organic raw milk and organic raw cheese, which I must say I don't drink organic raw milk, but I have had some organic raw cheese in the past. And I don't know. This is some interesting questions about the safety of those products.
Yes, they are delicious. And all of the rage now, but it does bring into question their safety. So this was a study that was done by a group and was recently published in the June issue of Emerging Infectious Diseases that suggested that unpasteurized dairy products cause 840 times more illnesses and 45 times more hospitalizations than pasteurized products do.
Well, and that also begs the question of how many illnesses they're reporting, which I thought could be in the thousands, but actually it was not. It was 760 reported cases of foodborne illness caused by unpasteurized milk and raw milk cheeses, and 22 of these people required hospitalization. Now, that may not seem like a lot, but compared to using the pasteurized milk and the pasteurized cheeses, these things didn't occur like this. So the question is that these are contaminated frequently with bacteria that are harmful. Right. That's a problem.
Yeah. I mean, the bacteria that they linked it to were bacteria like E. coli and Salmonella, Listeria, Campylobacter. And Campylobacter, Adam, I'm sure you remember from med school, it can lead to this awful syndrome called Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a progressive paralysis that some people recover from, but some people can pass away from this.
Yeah. I don't think before we have everyone out there who is a strong proponent of these writing to us, we understand that this is an issue that has lots of feeling behind it. And so we bring this issue out here for discussion. We bring it out. This is what the data, the Food and Drug Administration actually prohibits distribution of raw milk across state lines, and they don't permit the sale of raw milk for human consumption and advises states not to, but states do have the ability to do this. 19 states prohibit raw milk sales. 31 have regulations that allow consumers. We'll ask our health sciences librarians to put up a kind of a statewide map of which states allow and which states don't. I think it's a conversation. The big point is that just because it's labeled organic or local doesn't necessarily mean it's safe to consume. One example I know is like organic tobacco. It's not any safer than non-organic tobacco, but it could be marketed as such. We don't think all products clearly – we're a big proponent of organics, but we also want to acknowledge that there can be issues in which safety is really important.
Yeah. I think the most important is to do your research, know your local laws, know where is safe to buy food, and just do your job as an active consumer.
Do your due diligence.
Exactly.
Well, due diligence, this next research that matters is about zinc, lozenges, and cold.
This is a study that was done that was actually a meta-analysis of three different controlled studies that looked at the recovery rate of a common cold after taking a fair amount of zinc, 80 to 92 milligrams a day, which is about 10 times the recommended amount for a healthy man and woman.
And basically what they show through these combination systematic reviews is not different than what we've known before, which is that zinc at a higher dose as a supplement taken around the time started early in a cold does hasten recovery rate. It may be a day or two more. But the problem really is about potential side effects. I know you've taken zinc before, and the taste or the gastrointestinal side effects was an issue, correct?
It was. I personally cannot take zinc because every time I take it, it just causes awful stomach upset. However, they reported that some zinc lozenges have an unpleasant taste, but whatever the lozenges were that they did not say, used in the study did not present such a problem.
The more serious issue would be related to smell problems. And there are reports, and the FDA issued a public health warning about many over-the-counter zinc-containing products. One that was called Zicam should not be used because of what's called anosmia and hyposmia. Hope I'm saying those words right. Not easy words to say, let alone spell. But reduced smell and loss of smell, those would be serious problems because that's what gives a lot of food flavor when we can smell it.
I agree. I'd rather just wait that extra day.
Wait an extra day. More to come. Our last research that matters relates to something that's really common, affects me, affects you, probably all of our family members, but it's the linkage between certain what's called non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents, and in this case, very common ones, things like naproxen, Celebrex, ibuprofen, things that are sold over-the-counter and by prescription all across the world, and risk of heart attacks.
Yes. This was an interesting one to me. This was a study that was done with a group of researchers from Canada, Finland, and Germany that studied, like Adam mentioned, really common non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, or NSAIDs. And they did. They actually linked the NSAIDs to a higher risk of cardiac disease and heart attack.
Yeah, they said they were most vulnerable during the first month of using these medications, and those were taking higher doses at the highest risk. This is an observation study. It's not a randomized controlled trial. I do think this, combined with other studies, should be a word of caution to doctors, to patients, that, you know, if you can take any medication or a non-medication, in this case for pain, it's probably better to take not any medication, and then to take the least medication that you can within a class, and then maybe take the safest medication when comparing two different ones. And this is something you could talk with your doctor about. Acetaminophen for many patients may be a safer alternative. This is common, interesting, and important.
It is. It definitely changes my practice. I'm going to be a lot more cognizant of when I prescribe these medicines.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we're going to be talking with Dr. Robert McNutt, President and CEO of You Choose Medical and author of Your Health, Your Decision, about why patients and doctors should approach healthcare as partners and how to do so. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Carolyn Roberts. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Adam, we'll be talking with Dr. Robert Allen McNutt, President and CEO of You Choose Medical and author of Your Health, Your Decisions, How to Work with Your Doctor to Become a Knowledge-Powered Patient. And we're talking about why patients and doctors should approach healthcare as partners and how to do so.
Welcome, Dr. McNutt.
Oh, thank you. Great to be here.
Tell us a little bit about what led you into this field of decision making and motivated you to write a book to help guide physicians and patients towards that shared decision making.
And what you oftentimes call the history of failed decision making.
Right. I was an oncologist, and I was in private practice. And I became very aware, I guess because of a general sense of the science, that patients were taking treatments on, and we were giving patients treatments and suggesting treatments as a community of oncologists that had a lot of trade-offs involved in them. And I never felt, even from the day I practiced, that it could be me that could tell a person what they would do. And the reason I felt that is because all decisions that we make, if there's a science behind them, involve a trade-off, Adam. And there's options for care, and one option may be better from a disease perspective, but almost always is that option that's better on the disease perspective is worse for you on a possibility of side effects of a treatment. And since there's a trade-off, there's going to be a little bit added benefit and a little bit of added harm. I thought that that was something that the profession of medicine should do to inform patients so they could make that trade-off. They're the ones that had to decide the value of those therapies. Was a little bit better worth a little bit more? And how would people do that? And I spent an awful lot of time trying to figure out how to do that with patients. And it would raise the ire of some patients, which would demand of me, tell me what to do. But I would say, no, I'm going to help you decide what you have to do, what the consequences of your choice may be before you choose, not after. And I became very aware that patients could be very smart, could learn, could understand the trade-off. And when they did, what struck me is they often chose differently than the medical system was proposing. And that really intrigued me. And in fact, I knew in my data as an oncologist that I probably had less than 50% fewer people on treatments than my colleagues did, and had the same outcomes and sometimes even better outcomes. So I said, this is real. I've got to figure out how to do this better.
Let me ask you a question, because I think this belief that we can give people more information. And I'm thinking fast forwarding to today, and we're in this world of evidence-based medicine. And you know, I see when we get cancer treatments, and certainly when the toxicity could be so high, needing to bear off, when we talk about surgery or not surgery. Let's take a common condition, though, like a sore throat, a strep throat, and someone gets a positive strep test, meaning that we know what's causing the sore throat, how do you have conversations, or do you have conversations about, well, should you take antibiotics or not? That's a mantra. I don't think I'm thinking in my own situation. I don't usually have a conversation with the patient, nor does the patient ask for it, about whether they should take antibiotics. Should we be doing that?
I do. I talk to people about uncertainty. It raises a fascinating issue. What is the trade-off of giving an antibiotic for a strep throat? And I'm an oncologist, and I think this juxtaposes what got me so interested in helping people make choices, because the trade-offs were very onerous. We were talking about a little bit more life, but a lot of decline in quality of life. A lot of those decisions that we play out in ambulatory care don't have those remarkable trade-offs. And I've studied sore throat too much with Bob Santor and others, and I still don't know what the trade-off is. Yeah, and because people don't have very low risk for taking an antibiotic, and they have a benefit that's not very big either, right? And most of the time, their benefit is unmeasurable, or it's measured in a little less sickness for a few days, but there's a lot of variability around them, some of those outcome measures. And the trade-off on what is the real risk of it are relatively small, and we talk about it on a population perspective from, antibiotic resistant, but from an individual perspective, that risk is exceedingly low. That decision really, in my mind, is not necessarily a trade-off decision. I think that's a fascinating question. But I have presented people with the uncertainty.
So when you are thinking about, and you even talk about patients sometimes being overwhelmed if they're bombarded with options for care, information overload, can you say a little bit more or an example when, and maybe the strep throat is a good one, Adam, that if we go through all the pros and cons of this very kind of low-risk decision-making process, that might be information overload. But certainly in your oncology practice, when you have patients with a cancer diagnosis, all these different options could be confusing. How do you navigate when to give all the information, when to summarize, and when to guide a patient who says, no, doc, just tell me what to do?
Great question. I think what I meant by patients are overwhelmed is that, I'll give you an example. In my book, I tell of a woman who actually, I was her eighth second opinion physician. And she had received all these options. And they were all in the detail of what the options entailed. Well, you'll go through this, and then you'll do this, and we have to do this, and then you'll follow up here, and you'll go there. And they're overwhelmed with kind of the process of care. But never have I yet, in 40 years of practice, had a person come to me and know what the marginal values of those options were.
Give an example in this case that you're talking about.
Here's one that's recent. Okay, I have a woman who's came to me as a consultant, and that's what I do now, is I help people through medical decisions as a consultant, who had breast cancer. She was told what was going to happen. She was told she was going to get chemotherapy. It would be three drugs. This is how it would occur. We're going to put a port in. You'll be here every week because we want to reduce your side effects of care. And you're going to lose your hair, and you're going to do this, and you're going to do that. And then we're going to get you over to a radiation oncologist. And they're going to talk about what other additional treatments we're going to have. But we won't start that for 6 weeks. And I'm getting confused even just talking to myself. So when she came to me, I said, well, did they tell you why they said three chemotherapy agents? And she said, no, they handed me a guideline. I said, oh, okay. Did they talk to you about two or one? No, not at all. So part of the informing process is to actually take them from the information that doesn't really matter down to the information that really does.
Well, we need to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue talking with Dr. Robert McNutt, President and CEO of You Choose Medical, and author of a fascinating book called Your Health, Your Decisions, about why patients and doctors should approach healthcare as partners and how to do so. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Robert Allen McNutt, President and CEO of You Choose Medical and author of Your Health, Your Decisions, about why patients and doctors should approach healthcare as partners and how to do so. And before the break, we talked a little bit about your book and your experiences as an oncologist and now as a consultant for patients, guiding patients through decision-making parts of their life and their health. You also offer a decision-making checklist for patients. I wonder if you could walk through what is a decision-making checklist for patients and how might that apply to our listeners as they could potentially adapt it to their own visits with a physician.
And maybe even take a disease example, one that's we're talking about a lot today, prostate-specific antigen testing.
The checklist I developed with the pushing of the publishers, and I think it was a good idea, and the main intent of it is to have people understand, number one, to slow down. I think the first two things in the checklist are slow down. You don't have to make a decision urgently. You have time to figure out what the trade-offs are. And then the checklist goes through what you need to know to make a decision. And it focuses on getting the patient to understand that they have to know numbers. They have to know the outcomes and what are the differences in those outcomes from both the disease and the treatment standpoint for all the options of care so they can make that trade-off. So it's kind of a slow-down checklist. But it also makes them focus, hopefully helps them focus on the actual trade-offs that they have to make. How much benefit, how much harm.
So with an area like prostate-specific testing, the PSA testing that people hear a lot about, complicated discussion, you would start out by giving people the information about how much benefit they might get, if any, and how much harm they might get, if any?
That's right. I don't do many decisions around PSA because I think there's almost 400,000 men that have been in randomized trials of PSA testing, and there's been never a benefit shown. So there's no difference in mortality rate from prostate, which raises the point. There's no decision to make if there's no added benefit, and there's no then you have to go look at the harm. So PSA testing is an interesting one. I'm dealing a lot with women now, Adam and Christy, with ductal carcinoma in situ, or looking at bilateral mastectomy. That's a fascinating decision, too, because there's no evidence that bilateral mastectomy has any benefit to the person whatsoever. So from a decision-making perspective, one of the great benefits of going through this process is people start to see where there's some value and where there is not value in some of the options that are proposed to them.
Does heuristics have any role here? And this comes from the vantage point of when people come into me, see me a number of times, they say, you know, Aunt Hilda had this done to her and it worked and her life was saved. And almost no matter what I might say, that heuristic, that view really informs how they see things. How do you deal with that?
Well, I tell them that you can't make a decision on that kind of thinking. And I found it's something very interesting. I understand the heuristics I've taught about them. I understand cognitive psychology. But when I inform someone and they actually see the numbers and we take the time it takes to get through a process of decision-making, the heuristics can go away. Mm. They become informed. And it's been an interesting part of my training. I thought I would love the heuristics, but I find that an informed patient doesn't behave like those people that were tested in heuristics. You know, one of the first things was, you know, value-induced bias and some of these things that, and how framing affects. I've never found that to be true in the actual practice of informing patients. Most of the time, people have heuristics because they're uninformed.
Well, a lot of people are, and physicians and researchers and patients alike, are interested in the concepts of apps or tools on our phone that can help guide patients, guide physicians towards this kind of shared decision making. Do you have, I know you have experience perhaps consulting with doctors or creating these yourselves, but what's your opinion on the role of these potential decision making tools to guide patients and physicians in this kind of decision making?
Christy, that's a great question. If I see there's one big defect in what I do and what I see patients struggle with, is the way that medical information is produced by the scientific community is horrible. And I've been an editor for over 27 years, and I've been fighting for a patient journal. I wanted to do a JAMA, called it PUJAMA, Patient JAMA. There has to be a place where people can get unbiased information that is useful so they can see absolute differences in outcomes from the disease perspective and the treatment perspective in a unified format. I believe there will be a day when people will go to a kiosk or to a website and they'll say, do I want my ear infection treated? And they will be able to see the randomized trial evidence of benefits and trade-offs in words and numbers that they understand. I do believe that will be a future, and I know that that's going to be a part of my life, is how can I produce information that people can use?
And we should let our listeners know that you were a medical editor at the Journal of the American Medical Association for a decade. One quick question. I've lectured in areas of the former Soviet Union and in a lot of countries where cross-culturally, some of the ways we view things I've found are not viewed the same way. And it may be that if I were to bring up, at least in my lecturing and talking with patients, this type of decision-making, I actually would be looked at as a bad doctor, that I don't know which way is right. Is this just something that's different in culture, or does what you propose go across all cultures?
Well, I've had a lot of cultural experience. I have Thailand, Colombia. It's funny you see it. I just did two Skype consults, from one from the UK and one from France. And I actually find the opposite. I think that they're more rational than the U.S. population. So I haven't found your experience, Adam. I think that going through the process and letting them understand science, and I try to do that in my book a little bit, and they get very sophisticated very quick when they start seeing these numbers of benefits and harms. And people overwhelmingly misestimate benefit and harm. So this is a real informing, educating process. And so I think it's a universal thought process. It's a universal way to make decisions. And it probably is applicable even outside of medicine.
Do people overestimate the benefits and tend to underestimate harms? Is that what doctors do, patients?
Always. I give you an example in my book of a man who, with prostate cancer, who thinks surgery will cure him, with a 0% chance of death and an 80% chance of dying in the next 10 years if he doesn't have surgery. And I always ask patients, so I know what's in their head. And I also find that after they've given me a number, I show them the real number, they get it real quick. And they go, whoa. And they go, oh. And that changes their thought process, and I find often changes their decisions.
Now, for our listeners, we are so grateful to have this time with you, and we will certainly put a link to your book and eventually to your new book up on our blog. But if you could leave our listeners with one lesson or one comment today for all listeners to take home, what would that be?
I think it would be that they have the not only the opportunity, but they have the ability to fully participate in their medical decisions. And they just have to slow down, think it through, get a good doctor to talk to them about the science behind the choices they have to make, and they can really improve their ability to get to their best health care.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you very much, Christy and Adam. I enjoyed it.
Well, we appreciate you helping us slow down and not move too fast.
Yeah, great.
We've been talking with Dr. Robert Allen McNutt, President and CEO of You Choose Medical and author of Your Health, Your Decisions, about why patients and doctors should approach healthcare as partners and how to do so. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Caroline Roberts. Caroline, for the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to listen to listeners' health questions and concerns. They can send any comment they have to yourhealth, one word, at unc.edu. That's yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question today about what's happening when your blood pressure drops when you stand up.
Every so often when I stand up, my blood pressure drops and I feel dizzy. I've only passed out from it once, but I hate it when it happens. Is there anything that I can or should do?
Well, this is a common problem, isn't it?
Yes, I would say. I'd be curious. I have a couple questions that it comes to mind. How old are you? What medicines are you on? Have you been diagnosed with high blood pressure and are actually on potentially too many blood pressure medicines or too high of a dose of your blood pressure medicines?
Yeah, those are really important because if you're having something that you're taking that could be lowering your blood pressure, and it could be prescription or even it could be some things over the counter that maybe interact. There's some things that have, you know, lowering blood pressure medicines. You might have Parkinson's disease. Some of those medicines actually lower. Some of the antihistamines can lower your blood pressure. So really important. It's also really common that for a lot of people, when you stand up quickly, the blood's kind of been pooling in the legs, kind of sitting in the legs, and it just can't quite get up there quite fast enough. It's like, you know, I turn on my engine in my car. I can't quite go into reverse immediately. I have to just wait a few seconds before I can, like, get going. Same thing with your legs, right? Sometimes you have to kind of stand up a little more slowly, pump your legs a little bit, get those veins ready, and then stand.
I would say if this is something that you really have no reason for it to happen, that this is just something that happens to you, like Adam says, that if you stand up too quickly after you've been sitting, there's stuff that you can do to prevent it from getting worse. You can always make sure you're very well hydrated, make sure that you have lots of water on board as opposed to coffee or tea, sodas.
Yeah, you know, and if you've passed out once from this, that means actually maybe it's a little different for you. And this might be something that you may probably want to go see your primary care physician for, depending on your age, how often it's happening, your family history. You may or may not need more workup, including a blood count to make sure you're not anemic, look at your EKG to make sure you don't have some abnormality. We've seen some cases, though rare, of people who have kind of reduction in their autonomic nervous system. And those people actually may end up needing to see a cardiologist. Probably not for you, but what a great question.
Yes, I agree.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
I've been seeing a new doctor for the past few years, and last month he and I had a long discussion about the medicines I'm on. He ended up taking me off a few of my medications, and while I'm glad to not be taking them anymore, I wonder if there's any withdrawal or side effects of coming off of it that I need to be aware of.
What type of medicines, Caroline, do you think sometimes when you see a new patient, they come in, let's say on 6 or 7 medicines, and you're kind of reviewing it, and you think, I wonder if we can stop this. What sort of the sort of things you do go through your mind?
So a lot of them I think are medicines that are used to treat symptoms. So for example, there's occasionally medicines that will treat pain that I sometimes like to taper off. There's occasionally some medicines that might be kind of doing a dual duty, like if somebody was on an antidepressant two antidepressant medicines, we see if we can taper one off. Some nerve pain pills, I sometimes see if I can taper off.
Yeah, you know, sometimes it seems so much easier to add a medicine on than to take one off. I have a kind of a rule of thumb, particularly as people get a little bit older. It's like if we're adding a medicine or two on, maybe we should take at least one or two off.
Right.
You know, let's do this exchange and figure it out, because the more medicines, a lot of times the more side effects. That's always a worry we have.
I agree. And I always try, whenever I have a patient that has aged with me in my practice, I try to take a reevaluation of their medicines at the end, kind of their lifetime, and see the medicines that they're on and how important they are. For example, I might see somebody that I think might live for another 2-3 years. Is it really important for them to stay on that statin to lower their blood cholesterol? I typically have a discussion with the patient and talk to them about their medication burden.
In terms of side effects when stopping, that's always worth looking at too. A lot of times, someone will come in on 3 blood pressure medicines, and my first inclination, because their blood pressure looks good, says, let's stop one of them, which they're glad to hear. And then I've learned through time, unfortunately, is their blood pressure a lot of times goes back up. I stop an antidepressant medication, and the depression comes back. So a lot of times the medicines are on there for a reason. That doesn't mean one can't try to get off them. But, you know, if you stop an antidepressant quickly, you're not going to feel so good. You're going to feel nauseous. You're going to go through some withdrawal a lot of times. So slowly tapering, and also the ability to monitor. If you stop a blood pressure medication, someone's got to check the blood pressure.
Right. I agree. I think it is helpful to stop some medicines, but also having those discussions with your doctor specific to the medicines or your pharmacist about the withdrawal and side effects are an important thing to do.
Laura, what's our very next house call question about someone who unfortunately had to get some stitches?
My son fell off his bicycle and had to get a few stitches. It's healing normally, but it's not healed yet. His best friend invited him to go to the lake next weekend, and I'm fine with him going, but I'm hesitant to let him swim in the lake with his wound. What do you think?
Yeah, it's hard. I would be curious to the level that it's healed. I think that if it's just kind of scarred over and there's not any really open wound, I think it would be completely fine. I think that if you're nervous or you're hesitant, there's plenty of products on the market that you can use, waterproof Band-Aids that would help cover the wound if you're being extra cautious. I don't know. What do you think, Adam?
Yeah, I think those are, in general, good things. Part of it's like, where did this wound occur? If it, you know, happened on an area that's not under stress or tension, the back or the stomach, and you know, then there's no tension on that wound, there's no risk of it opening particularly, it's probably okay. If it happened on an elbow under a lot of tension and movement, and then it gets wet and moist, then I have a little bit more concern. Top of the shoulder, the scalp, I mean, you don't want those things scarring. On the other hand, you could put a waterproof bandage on top of it.
Yeah.
To keep it waterproof. So it's probably less about the water, because you can get rid of the contact with the water, than it is about the level of activity and pulling that scar. Laura, it's our very last house call.
I'm adopted, so I don't have any sense of the health history of my biological family. Do you recommend people in my situation getting any type of genetic testing, et cetera, to find out more about which health issues they might be prone to?
Well, this is really fascinating. And, it makes me think, Laura, we might want to at some point in time do a whole show about adoption. And there's so many issues that are important that this makes me think of that a lot of us don't think of. But, you know, adoption is really common in the United States alone.
It is.
2.5% of all births, hundreds of thousands around the world each year. And not only is it just those who get adopted, but also those who, for whatever reason, they may not know their family history.
Yeah, this prompted a lot of conversation with us, and I think we all probably have different ideas and viewpoints about what could potentially be helpful or hurtful to know.
Yeah, you know, one thing we understand is that genetic influences a lot of times are actually even more important than environmental influences, but let's not ignore one or the other, because certainly you can do lots of things to reduce that risk, being the proper weight, proper exercise, making sure mental health, other conditions, blood pressure is an issue, smoking. So we can do lots of things to improve people's health, and we should make sure that we don't ignore any of those. In terms of the genetic aspect, you know, there's more and more interest. I think there's an article in Nature magazine. We can actually ask our great health sciences librarians to post that. I think it was a year or two in Nature, about genetics and medicine and what it might mean to have selective genetic testing. Now, that's easier said than done, because you might have to see a geneticist or really an in-depth conversation with your family doctor to talk about what type of genetic testing.
Right. It gets into a whole different level. I mean, we all have heard about the breast cancer risk and ovarian cancer risk with the BRCA gene. And if you're a male that's been adopted, do you want to get tested for that for your future daughters? It's an interesting kind of, I guess, hole to go down.
Yeah. So I think this, again, is a really important question. We're really excited by it. In the future, we do know that more people will get genetic testing, and we can do something with it. Because obviously, if you have a genetic risk of colon cancer, and I've got people who, everyone in their family's had colon cancer, we want to be able to screen earlier. because we can do something about it. If we can't do something about it, it's a little bit less clear. Well, that'll conclude the House Calls for today. We want to thank all of our listeners for coming and listening and conversing with us on your health. We hope we've answered questions that are important to your health. You can send your own questions to yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes. And we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. Our great guest today, Dr. Robert McNutt. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Caroline Roberts.
And we'll talk with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.